Epigenetics is at the epicenter of modern medicine. At least that's what one expert says. You're born with your genes, you're exposed to your environment, and then you age. How these factors interact to cause disease is the study of epigenetics. Exactly 50 years ago, the structure of DNA was discovered. Roll on 40 years. The entire human genome has been mapped. 25,000 human genes have been identified and sequenced. But wait, 95% of the genetic material sits alongside those genes. Is it junk or is it the key to controlling your health destiny? Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Dr. Nerida. Epigenetics is a relatively new science and there's so much to learn. So let's start by watching an excerpt of A Ghost in Your Genes by PBS.
This odd strain of agouti mice provides a visual clue. Despite the difference in color and size, they're twins, genetically identical. Both, therefore, have a particular gene called agouti. But in the yellow mouse, it's switched on all the time.
And as a consequence, it inappropriately blocks a receptor in what's called the satiation center of the brain, which tells mice and us when we're full. So the yellow animals literally eat themselves into obesity, diabetes, and cancer.
So what switched the agouti gene off in the thin mouse? Exercise? Atkins? No. A chemical tag called a methyl molecule. Composed of carbon and hydrogen, it affixes near the agouti gene, shutting it down. Living creatures possess millions of tags like these. Some, like methyl molecules, attach to DNA directly. Other types grab the proteins called histones around which DNA wraps and tighten or loosen them to turn genes on or off.
Joining our discussion on turning genes on and off today is Dr. Heidi Schultz-Meyer, a biochemist working in human genetics, and Dr. John Kelly, a lifestyle medicine specialist. Welcome to the program. Dr. Schultz, you worked on the Human Genome Project. What was the purpose of the project?
The purpose of the project was to find out the sequence of the letters that make up our genome, because until that time we didn't know, we knew bits of it, but not the complete thing. So the Human Genome Project wanted to find out the sequence of the letters that in this genome we have the genes, so we could find out the genes also.
Now, did you discover a gene?
Well, I worked in my thesis, yeah, I cloned some genes, found out the sequence of some genes, yes.
So did they call it the Heidi gene?
No.
They didn't?
No.
Oh, shame. Now, Dr. Kelly, we know that there is a small portion that's gene. What about all the non-gene genetic material that's there? How does that
Because
function?
A chromosome is really about 50% DNA by weight and about 50% non-DNA. So the epigenome really consists of lots of switches, proteins that organize the DNA. And so that's as important we're finding as the DNA is.
So the switches can turn genes on and off?
Absolutely. You know, every cell in our body comes from a single cell, right? When the egg and the sperm join. Mm. So actually every cell in our body has the copy of the same DNA. And some of it makes an ear and some of it makes a brain.
So the genes are identical whether it's the ear or the brain.
That's right. But the switch settings have been very different during the development of the organ of the child.
So during when we're an embryo, switches must be pretty active, turning genes on, off, depending on which tissue it's differentiating into.
That's correct.
So how can that impact our health?
Well, of course, the studies in animals have shown, for example, in the Goody mouse, have shown that a diet that methylates the DNA, which changes the switch setting, could actually turn off genes for that have been engineered into the mouse for obesity and heart disease.
Hmm.
So that diet was with folic acid type.
Right. Diet. Now, Heidi, there are different switches, different mechanisms. What are they? We mentioned methylating.
Yes, there's methylation, so you put one switch on top of the cytosines in your DNA, and then you can, the DNA is a very fine, strong, and so that it doesn't get tangled up in your cell, you have to wrap it up around balloons, let's call them the histones. And you have to pack that so that, you know, it doesn't get tangled. So you have these histone arms that wrap around the DNA. And depending on what you have, let's say on the fingers of the histones, they're closely bound or they're loose. And that, you know, depends. And that way you can also change the amount of a gene that you can read or not read.
Mm-hmm. So as you described previously on our epigenetics show, it's like a book and those pages are closed off.
Yes.
They're stapled shut.
Yeah.
And you can't read them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's methylation and there's histone. Yeah. Changing or modification.
And then there's one more that we know of. Maybe we'll find a fourth and fifth one. And that's
right.
Very small RNA copies, like only 20 to 25 bases long. And it's like taping something on top of the page of the book that you want to read. So even though you open the book and you have the letters there, you can't read them because you have a post-it taped on top of it.
Ah.
Well, actually,
so
yeah, it's kind of that way.
Obscures that gene from...
Yeah. Actually, a copy of the book, if you want to be scientifically correct.
Right. And so when we say a switch is on, that gene is what we call being read or expressed.
Expressed. Mm-hmm.
And then when it's closed off, we say it's
turned off or quiescent.
Quiescent or turned off. Mm-hmm. Well, we still have lots to cover about epigenetics with our experts on today's show. We also have a healthy cooking and exercise for you. Go Healthy for Good has just begun. But before we take a short break, enjoy some doctor's orders.
Honey, I'm feeling thirsty. Could you give me a drink of water, please?
Sure. Would you like some bleach with that?
Bleach? What are you trying to do? Kill me or something?
Well, you know, the water department puts a little bit in to kill the bacteria, so if a little is good, maybe more would be better.
Well, yeah, I know that what they do is really important because the bacteria can make us sick or even kill us, but too much of a good thing is a bad thing.
You're absolutely right. I was joking. But you know, the Environmental Protection Agency, they called for stricter guidelines a few years ago on four chemicals that are in our drinking water that can cause cancer.
Yeah, and long-term excess chloramine in our water, that's one of the chemicals they use, can cause anemia.
And not only that, infants and children, if they get excessive amounts of chlorine, you know, when there's a storm or something, more chlorine goes into the water. If they get excess amounts, then their nervous system can be affected.
That's why we've got a charcoal water filter right here at our house. We just put the tap water in here. It filters down through the charcoal. It purifies the water, takes out those chemicals. We have beautiful water on the bottom.
That's right. So if you drink tap water, you really should get a filter. Although I guess the alternative might be to get bottled spring water. But then you know, you're making an environmental footprint that's perhaps unnecessary. And there will be chemicals leaching into the water from the plastics, like BPA and things like that. So it's probably better to do the filtered tap water.
So what are you going to give me to drink, doctor?
Tap water. 8 glasses a day. Doctor's orders.
Well, I'll drink to that. Very good. Thanks, doctor.
I was once in the town of Ljubljana in Slovenia. Across the river was a bridge where romantics from all over the world attached love padlocks with their names written on. These locks were locked and the keys thrown away to signify their eternal love for one another. Padlocks rust, people change, relationships end, but Jesus' love is everlasting.
Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In His great mercy, He has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead.
A movement toward daily scripture reading is underway. It's called Revived by His Word. The plan? To read one chapter of the Bible per day. The goal? To direct the attention of participants to the importance of knowing Jesus through His Word.
Welcome back to Go Healthy for Good. We're in the kitchen and we're going to do another one of Ernestine Finley's natural lifestyle cooking recipes. Phil, which one did you choose?
Well, you're going to have to hear me out on this one.
Yeah?
I've chosen donut rolls.
Donut rolls.
Donut rolls. And they're actually a lot healthier than they may sound. These are terrific. They're rolls that look like donuts. They're really visual and they've got terrific nutrients in them.
Wonderful. So what's in them?
Well, we start out with... 1 cup of warm water, 1 tablespoon of active dry yeast, 1/3 cup of soy milk, 3 tablespoons of honey, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 cup of light olive oil, 1 teaspoon of vanilla, 1.5 cups whole wheat pastry flour, and 2.5 cups of unbleached enriched flour.
So how do we put this together?
Well, let's start mixing it. We're gonna take our ingredients, and I'm gonna start with our liquid ingredients, but first we need to get the yeast going.
Okay.
So we've got our water there. We've got our yeast here. And we would just want to kind of set that aside for a few minutes, let the yeast do its thing.
All right.
So we've got our soy milk, pouring that in. Our salt, you want 1 teaspoon. So you want to put some in. You won't put all that in.
Yeah, yeast likes a bit of salt and a bit of sweetener to really be active, doesn't it?
It does. And that's the yeast has always fascinated me. Yeah. I love just watching it and knowing kind of what it's doing. Could you hand me a spoon there?
Oh, actually, you could take this one because I've finished mixing.
This is our honey, and I think it's fascinating. A little fun fact about honey is that there are about 20,000 types of bees, but only 4 that produce honey.
Really?
So the honey that we get is from some very diligent worker bees.
Yep. And we're running out of honeybees in this country.
That's right.
Which is very sad. Now, so you've got milk and honey?
Yep. We've got...
The land flowing with milk and honey. It's right here in this bowl. Okay.
So, you know, before I forget, we've got to put in a little bit of oil.
Ah.
And that'll give our yeast just a few minutes. Or a few seconds.
Yep.
We can go ahead and throw that in.
All right.
And then we'll mix our flours as well.
Ah, so you've got all the wet ingredients together. Okay.
Now you want to be careful when you're doing this. You want to mix it up, but you don't want to knead it because it's just going to get a little bit tough on you. And I think it's also a good idea to put it in a little bit slowly so that you can mix it as you go. So we're going to mix it, get it all together, just so that this will give us the opportunity to play with it and put it on our sheet over there and roll it out. And this is a fun one with kids, if you've got kids in the household. It's a fun one for kids to get involved, especially making donut rolls and getting the whole like donut look and the shape of it. It's different from your traditional roll and bread. And so it's one that kids will really get excited about.
Yeah, I guess you could use all kinds of shapes of cutters, not necessarily have to use a donut cutter, but donuts are fun.
Well, the thing that I like is if If you don't enjoy cooking, it's little gadgets like this that make it a little bit more fun.
Mm.
And it's a reason to do a recipe like this. So I'm gonna have you roll this out.
All right, I'm gonna just scoot that across.
And you wanna do a little bit at a time.
All right.
And you only need it about a third of an inch thick, so you don't need to roll it
all
too
right.
flat.
So that's about it then.
And then you take our cutter here, and you do want to make sure that you get that center out. And these things can be just a little bit tricky. And right there you've got our first one.
Great.
And you're gonna set this out, let it rise until it gets to take on the shape and the feel and the look of a donut.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically once you've got that, you put it in the oven at about 350 for about 15 to 20 minutes.
Is that all? 15
That's
to 20
it.
Minutes? Mmm, fun. And then breakfast is ready.
That's exactly it. And you can see here, we added an extra ingredient. And like I always say, you can have a lot of fun with the food that you make. Make it personalized, make it something that you're really gonna enjoy, that your family will love, and that adds to the taste that you like.
Mm.
So we've added blueberries.
Fabulous.
And we've got a cup of our soy milk here.
Okay.
Just add
Shall
to
we,
it.
Let's shoot for the blueberry one. It looks really fun.
That was the exact one I was gonna reach for.
Mm.
And it's a very tasty roll.
Mm. That would be lovely for breakfast. Very light, I guess, because it's half white, half whole wheat. But it's a really light pastry-like consistency, isn't it? You wouldn't think that was bread, actually.
And it's healthy, and it's fun for the family.
Mm. Now, have you ever wondered what toxins might do to your epigenome? Then you want to watch this.
And genetics tell us that there is a high risk of developing the same disease, but it's not really sure they're going to have it because our genes are just part of the story.
Esteller suspected epigenetics was the rest. To find out, he and his team collected cells from 40 pairs of identical twins, aged 3 to 74. Then began the meticulous process of dissolving the cells until all that was left were the wispy strands of DNA, the master molecule that contains our genes. Next, researchers amplified fragments of the DNA, revealing both the genes and their epigenetic tags. Those that had been turned off appear as dark pink marks on the gel. Now, notice what happens when these genes are cut out and overlapped. The epigenetic effects stand out, especially when you contrast the genes of two sets of twins who differ in age. Here on the left is the overlapped DNA of 6-year-old Javier and Carlos. The yellow indicates where their genes are functioning identically. On the right is the DNA of 66-year-old Ana Marie and Clotilde. In contrast to the younger twins, hardly any yellow shines through. Their genome may be the same. Their epigenome clearly is not. Identical genes active in one twin may be shut down in the other. Thus, as the years pass, epigenetic changes accumulate in twins as in the rest of us.
One of the main findings of our research is that epigenomes can change in function of what we eat, of what we smoke, or what we drink. And this is one of the key differences between epigenetics and genetics.
Dr. Schultz, we know that there are a lot of toxins in our environment, and does epigenetics play a role in how we handle toxins? What's the, if we look at animal research, for first, because that was obviously done first, and then we'll go on to human research later. But any animal research around toxins?
Yeah, of course. Toxins mess up our genome, causing mutations, but also they mess up the epigenome. So they play around with the switches and turn things off that you need and turn on things that you don't need. So you probably heard about BPA, bisphenol A, which is a chemical substance that mimics estrogen. So it's not so good for you. And we find it everywhere in plastics and sealants and dental sealants and so on. And there was an experiment with mice, with agouti mouse. This mice has the particularity that it changes color depending on how much methylated this agouti gene is or not. And it can be yellow or it can be brown. And looking at it, you can tell if it's methylated or not methylated, so if it's on or off. And what they did is they had these agouti mice, and when they were pregnant, they exposed them to BPA. And they had another group that wasn't exposed to BPA, and a third group that had BPA exposure plus a special diet with a lot of methyl groups. And then they looked at, you know, the color of the fur of the descendants of these mice, and they found that, of course, you see a difference between the control diet and the BPA diet, or the
BPA mice, exposure. Yeah. Yes.
But the good thing is that if you are exposed to BPA but eat enough methyl donors, then you almost go back to the normal situation.
Wow, and I think we can see that on this graph, yeah, where you've got the difference, the toxin-exposed animals in orange, those who had no toxin exposure in bright green.
Exactly.
But then that turquoise is the group that had the healthy diet, if we call it the healthy diet?
Protective. Mm-hmm.
The protective diet. And
the bars look almost the same as the control group.
The turquoise and the bright green.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, Dr. Kelly, there's a study done with agouti mice just looking at, I know your interest is in lifestyle medicine, and so this was looking at kind of a lifestyle factor for the mice in terms of obesity, cardiovascular disease. Tell us about that work.
Well, this is, again, using the agouti mouse, which has genes engineered into it to cause it to get obese and heart disease, diabetes, and so on, usually for studies in medications or other treatments. But research was done at Duke University using a methylating diet to see if feeding a mother who was pregnant with a methylating diet could change the switch settings on those genes for disease in the offspring. And that was quite a remarkable study, a pioneering study, a lead study. Mm. And it was so remarkable, the researchers published in their documents saying they could see the effects of this for up to 3 to 4 generations.
Wow, and still, I think we've got a picture of that first generation, don't we?
Yes, where the Dr. Heidi was saying, the color of the mice tells us if the gene is on or off. And you can see the mother had the blonde coat, whereas the child, the baby, had a normal wild type brown coat. But if you do DNA testing, the genes for the disease and for the color coat is the same in both mice. So a remarkable study showing switch settings can change it.
And I noticed that the mother does have the kind of what we call the phenotype, the expression of that gene. She's fat.
Abby.
She just looks unhealthy. And that the baby is a mature adult mouse.
Yes.
Yes, fully grown. That's as big as it's going to get. Quite a difference.
Yes. In other words, the gene for obesity was there,
definitely,
but silenced or turned off during gestation, which is exciting.
Mm. Now, Heidi, what about the diet of, for example, mice or rats, and whether they're exposing their offspring to the risk of cancer? Because we're seeing cancer on the increase too.
Yeah.
Is there any work around that?
Yes, of course. Not in humans again, but in rats.
Yep.
And again, they had two groups of rats with a normal diet and a high-fat diet, the same amount of calories in both groups, but just different composition. And then they looked at the first generation, and they exposed all these pups to a carcinogen. Yeah, yes. Exactly.
That causes cancer or triggers cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they looked how many rats got cancer at what time. Mm-hmm. And we can see in the graph, as you can see in the first generation, all the pups from the mothers who had the high-fat diet during pregnancy, they got more cancer and earlier than the other pups.
So the top red line on that left-hand graph is the cancer rates?
Yes.
For the exposed pups,
yep.
And the control ones that didn't get the exposure, they're just underneath.
And you see, even at the end point, which was 22 weeks, I think, you have 20% more rats with cancer in the group from the high-fat diet than from the other group. So both groups got cancer because, I mean, you exposed them to a toxic agent, but they were kind of protected, the ones from the control diet. And the interesting thing is that you saw this effect not only in the first generation, but in the second generation. I mean,
so in their granddaughters?
Yes, even though the daughters ate a normal diet, not a high-fat diet. And this effect was lost, so to say, on the third generation.
So it went right through to the third generation.
In the third generation,
they reverted back to as if they had never had any exposure in their grandmother.
Yeah. Hmm. But with other agents that are estrogen similar, like BPA in this same study, they saw the effect even on the third generation.
Wow. Does a high-fat diet in rats change what their offspring want to eat?
There was a study published in 2008 where they fed a pregnant rat a high-fat diet. It's about 55 to 60% calories from fat. And this, they were able to trace the effect. In the developing fetus, it was an overexpression of a gene on chromosome 3 that led to actually the proliferation and development of more neurons than in the rat was not fed the high-fat diet. So this was actually making an anatomical change in the brain of the developing fetus. Those neurons became hormonally active during adolescence and adulthood and produced hormones that indeed increased the appetite for supersizing me, as also for high fat. Those animals preferred a high fat food to normal food. In fact, we look at the complete profile and we see it's very common to pediatric profile we're seeing today with young children having obesity, even preschool, early puberty, higher weight. And this could very possibly, even in humans, be affected by epigenetic changes of the diet of the mother during pregnancy.
Right. Wow, Drs. Kelly and Schultz will continue to give us this valuable information in just a moment. And when we come back from the break, we're ready to exercise with Sean. But first, let's take a look at today's medical news report. In the headlines today, gene signature drives breast cancer to the brain, gene mutation increases Alzheimer's, and cancer down following nuclear shutdown. Researchers have found that a specific genetic signature on circulating tumour cells may be responsible for slipping breast cancer cells into the brain. Breast cancer that spreads to the brain is fatal. However, the mechanism that gets it there is unknown. Houston researchers have found that when four particular genes are turned on, the circulating tumour cell lines are highly invasive and generate brain and lung metastases in mice. A gene variant in African Americans may increase their risk for Alzheimer's disease. Those with the gene are 80% more likely to get late onset Alzheimer's. Cholesterol is also a risk factor for Alzheimer's, and the same genes affect cholesterol metabolism. Perhaps this will provide a hint as to what is causing the disease. It may help develop targets for genetic testing, prevention, and treatment. Since the nuclear reactor closed in 1980, there have been 4,300 fewer than expected cases of cancer amongst residents of Sacramento County, California. Researchers found the decline was 4 times greater among women than men. Breast and thyroid cancers showed a significant decrease. Childhood cancers also dropped by almost 14% during the 6 years from 1988 to 1994. They continued to decline during the next decade. This is the first long-term study of the full population health impacts of the closure of a US nuclear reactor. So if you live near a nuclear plant, you may want to reconsider your options. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's medical news report.
Shout for joy to the Lord, all the earth. Worship the Lord with gladness. Come before him with joyful songs. Know that the Lord is God. It is he who made us, and we are his. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. Enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Give thanks to him and praise his name. For the Lord is good and his love endures forever. His faithfulness continues through all generations.
I pray for the people that are poor and don't have any homes or no food at all on the street.
I pray for people to be safe.
I pray that a lot of things in the world would be fair.
I pray for homeless people.
I pray that I do a good job in school.
Do not worry, saying, "What shall we eat?" Or, "What shall we drink?" Or, "What shall we wear?" For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well.
Welcome back to Go Healthy for Good. Sean, what have you got for us today?
I got our resistant bands, so then we're going to jump into that in a second. Let's get warmed up first.
Okay.
All right, let's do some jumping jacks.
All right.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Let's do 10. All right, regular jumping jacks in 3, 2, and 1. Go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. All right, let's shake it out a little bit. Okay. Now, you can use different resistant bands. If you're out there getting a resistant band, you can find the yellow, blue, green. There are so many different types. So keep in mind there are different resistances for these bands. Okay?
Right.
I don't know which one this is, but I think
that's
this is the toughest.
About a medium,
this is the toughest
it's
one.
Not the toughest.
This is the
toughest. Oh, that's the toughest one. That's the 100-pounder.
I got to keep my...
This is the girly one?
Yeah. No. So the first exercise we got are high pulls. Okay? You can either use 1 foot or you can use both feet, depending on the thickness of your band, okay? Now, for high pull, you're working your delts, okay? And what you want to do is end up in this position here where your arm is in a V,
okay?
That's a great way to get a good contraction of your delts, okay? So we're going to go for 5 in 3, 2, and 1. Go. 1, 2, 3, 4. We're going to hold it on 5 and 5. Okay, this is the position right here that you want to hold and squeeze your delt, okay? And back down. Perfect.
Right.
Again, working the delts, okay?
Feel it.
So let's combine that and do a combination exercise where we're working together.
All right.
One arm is going to go up, the other one's going to go down, and we're going to keep alternating, okay? Working that scapula area again, but also working your rear delt, okay?
Okay.
So we're going to alternate, okay? All right, in 3, 2, and 1, go. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Let's hold it there.
Whoops.
Uh-oh, there you go. Perfect, okay? Great way to use your partner. And of course, if I had a thicker band, you would have to work a little bit more too.
Yeah.
Okay? So here's another one to work the delts, okay? We're gonna target these delts today. You're gonna do a side lateral raise, and I'm gonna do a front, okay?
Okay.
That works, so we can show 2 different variations. Again, working your delts.
All right.
Okay? You're gonna go side, I go front in 3. We're gonna go 5 reps, 2 and 1, go. Now, don't rush, because if you rush, it can snap back and it can hurt. Right there. All right, let's do one more. Okay? So once you're doing these exercises, you don't want to rush because the resistance of the band will snap back and it can hurt you. So when you get to the top of these exercises, you want to be able to squeeze.
So just pause a
little. Exactly, pause a little bit. Okay? Not bad.
All right. Yeah, those doubts are thanking you.
Yeah, they are. They burn a little bit.
Yeah.
So you could do multiple reps. You know, I think for resistance bands, you can go up a little bit higher in reps, from 15 to 20 reps, mm-hmm. depending on the level of resistance you have.
Right.
But if you keep a nice level of a good number of reps, you get a nice cardio burn too at the same time. For that exercise, that was a great one. If you can, I was doing the front.
Yeah.
You can do the side. So here and then.
Oh,
here.
Yeah. So do one of each.
One of each.
That creeps it interesting.
Absolutely.
I like also doing a bit of chest work with these.
I like
two.
That.
Yeah.
I haven't done this before.
It's really.
So you put the band behind you?
Yeah, and then you wrap around as much as you need, depending on your resistance band.
Okay.
And then you can either bring them together that way.
So the resistance here allows you to squeeze your chest.
That's right.
I like that. I've never done that before.
Yeah. For us girls who, you know, some of us actually get on the machines at the gym and we can't get them together. Whereas this, we can get them together. It gives us that warm and fuzzy feeling. Like, yay, I really have got arms that work.
There's certain machines I just will not get on, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like
the adductor muscle. I won't even talk about that. The adductor. So I would rather use some type of bodyweight exercise for that. But I can't look you in the face and I just can't do it. Okay. So let's stretch it out. Okay.
All right.
We're going to take the right hand here across the body. Switch. And then we can also take this right hand and put it right back here. Okay, you're stretching out that tricep.
Mm-hmm.
Switch sides. And then get a nice stretch, come all the way down. Again, I like to bounce just a little bit to get a nice stretch of my hamstring. And come up nice and slow.
Mm.
All right.
Wow, that feels good.
It does, right?
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
We'll see you next time.
Yes, you will.
And we're going to watch another Ageless Advantage.
Ever heard of metabolic syndrome? Well, it is a disease cluster that includes high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, obesity, heart disease, and type 2 diabetes. And diet may play a role. The Adventist Health Study recently found that almost twice as many non-vegetarians developed metabolic syndrome than vegetarians. Therefore, the non-vegetarians had nearly twice the risk of developing heart disease and diabetes. These findings are extremely significant for prevention. Going vegetarian and avoiding metabolic syndrome is another Ageless Advantage.
Welcome back. Now I'm going to answer some questions that you've texted, called, or posted on our Facebook page. Marion posted on Facebook, "Blessed by your show, keep up the good work." Well, thanks, Marion. And a text message came in, "If I switch to a vegan diet, how can I be sure my diet contains a good supply of amino acids, calcium, and B vitamins?" Well, amino acids, or protein, is present in almost all foods. However, the most concentrated sources that will include all the essential amino acids that you have to get from food will include a variety of whole grains and legumes. Now, you don't have to eat them together. You can have them at different meals in the day. And there are many meals, though, that do include them together, like rice and beans, rice and lentils, chickpeas in a pita pocket, black bean tortillas, beans on toast, and the list goes on. So just be creative. For calcium, green leafy veggies should be a staple every day. And then you can also add calcium with sesame seeds or tahini or tofu. So tofu's got your protein and your calcium. But you can also supplement if you don't think you're getting enough. Calcium citrate, 500 milligrams a day. For B vitamins, whole grains and vegetables and some fruit will give you plenty. Thanks for sending those questions. Call us with your health question. Our number is 855-400-HEALTHY. And remember, you can also text us or post your question on our Facebook page. Now, before we continue our discussion about epigenetics, take a look at this. Bon appetit. This winter squash has a sweet, nutty taste similar to that of a pumpkin. It has yellow skin and has very orange fleshy pulp. When it gets ripe, the colour becomes a deep orange and it gets sweeter and richer. That colour tells us that there are lots of vitamin A and vitamin E in there. But it's also a good source of vitamin C, manganese, magnesium and potassium. If you're low in magnesium, you can get muscle cramps, tingling in the limbs, and severe problems in the nervous system. You can also get a low level of calcium and potassium. One of the most common ways to eat butternut squash is to roast it dry or with a little oil and bake it at 400 degrees for about half an hour. But it also makes a wonderful soup. Just add some herbs or spices to season it, and bon appetit. Dr. Heidi, is there a direct interaction between the nutrients we eat and our gene switches?
Of course. I mean, the machinery is quite complicated. You'll see a figure which simplifies it a lot because yes, it's a whole chain of reactions. But what we eat, I mean, the nutrients that we need for the methylation process, we have to get them from our diet.
Mm.
So we need a lot of methyl donors and some coenzymes and stuff to get the enzymes working. So
on this image, you can see that there is a the food comes in, but it's broken down to all these different constituents.
Yeah,
and then that's what causes the. I mean, I know this. It would be lovely if we could look into our factories like this, but they cause all these changes, yeah. Do they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so what kind of foods might we be looking at to get those particular nutrients?
Well, you might want to have a good look at the table that we're going to see right now because, I mean, many of these things are not the things that you like to eat.
Yes.
But, you know, you need methionine, folic acid, the vitamin Bs, choline. So you...
Which foods would we be looking at?
Nuts, leafy, green, vegetables, broccoli, soy, milk.
Those are, I like this.
Yeah, but not everyone.
It's true.
Probably not bestseller in all the fast food.
Yeah.
But those are all very simple foods, yes, to be able to access and to impact our genes. It's not something that we have to go hunt.
Isn't it wonderful that it's that available? So it's simple. You know, she didn't give us anything that cost $1 million.
Right, exactly. Now, I think Dr. Dean Ornish has done a lot of work around nutrition. Tell us what he's found out about epigenetics.
Yes, in the Geminal study they did, they used basically the same treatment protocol that he had used in his prevention of heart disease. But they did this in 30 men with prostate cancer, and the men agreed to, instead of having chemo or surgery, they had a lifestyle intervention program for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And they donated serial biopsies of the prostate, so they actually had the tissue from the cancer cells, which they could isolate messenger RNA. And messenger RNA is the molecule that's used to express or turn genes into proteins. And when they did this, they found that there were over 500 genes that were changed in the 90 days.
Wow.
About 450 that were associated with cancer production had been turned down, and about 50 associated with cancer prevention and fighting were actually turned up.
And I think we have that gene expression profile.
Yes,
there.
This is what's called a heat map, and you can see the darker colors on the left side, where this was the before the intervention. And then on the right side, you can see that in general, there's lighter colors, meaning less gene expression in this particular group.
So same men, same tumor,
three months
between them, and there was this amazing difference.
And you know what's so amazing about this too, Narada, is that they measured things like blood pressure and cholesterol and blood sugars, and those also improved. Even though they were treating them for cancer, they were improving and reducing their heart disease risk. Isn't that marvelous?
That is, because I always say, well, you know, there's nothing that can fix everything.
Mm-hmm.
But you do that with With a diet?
You might find there is.
And you find that you do a holistic program?
That's right.
And you really can almost fix everything, can't you?
Everything gets better, at least.
Did those men have long-term follow-up?
I've not seen results published beyond the 90 days, but I know that they are being followed.
Right, so watch this space. Heidi, does it matter which oils that we eat, whether we use olive oil or coconut oil, for example?
Well, it does make a difference. And again, I study with men.
Men, and yes.
The first 2 weeks, the 20 men ate the same diet, and then they split them up, and half of them got a diet that was rich in saturated oils, like coconut oil, and the other half a monounsaturated,
like olive oil.
And after 8 weeks receiving these diets that had the same calories, just different types of fatty acids, they did a profile, a gene expression profile from adipose cells. So they had to make a small biopsy, take out some cells, and they looked at the difference of the expression of genes. And they found that between both groups, there was a difference. You can see it in the graph, in the expression. So again, between the two groups, in the group that ate the saturated fat, there was an increase in the expression of pro-inflammatory genes, and you don't want that because then anything, you know, will make your body react to that.
So that one's very red with all those pro-inflammatory?
Yes, that was the difference in the expression between the two groups. And the bad thing is that they also had lower expression of an anti-inflammatory gene. So just 20 men with different oils.
And we know that the inflammatory condition is going to put us at risk of a number of things, isn't it, John?
Oh, yes. Well, one of the most common ones is probably has to do with arthritic-type conditions, but it could be something autoimmune conditions. Autoimmune.
And then also cardiovascular diseases.
Oh, that's true.
Have an inflammatory basis, metabolic syndrome.
This low-level inflammation is associated with a lot of chronic diseases.
Now, tell us about exercise. A single bout of exercise can actually change our epigenome.
Yes, yes. A study recently published showed that actually they were looking to find out how long you needed to exercise before you would see gene expression changes. And interestingly, the study didn't actually quite answer that because they found it even within 20 minutes of a bout of exercise would change gene switch settings in muscle tissue. So we know these switches can change quite quickly with something as simple as exercise.
Amazing.
We still have lots to cover on today's show with our experts. Don't go away, we'll be right back.
Death is the only inescapable, unavoidable, sure thing. We are sentenced to die the day we're born.
Death is a debt we all must pay.
Some people are so afraid to die that they never begin to live.
Every man must do two things alone. He must do his own believing and his own dying.
Death is not a period, but a comma in the story of life.
He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.
Welcome back. Remember to call us with your health question at 855-400-HEALTHY. Now, today, we're talking about epigenetics with Dr. Callie and Dr. Schultz. If identical twins have identical genes, then they'll suffer the same diseases, right? Well, Manal Estala of the Spanish National Cancer Center wanted to know how true that might be.
But their epigenome they potentially can alter, and particularly that of their children. And that brings in responsibility, but it also brings in hope. You're not necessarily stuck with this. You can alter this.
Might our lifestyle choices resonate down the ages, affecting people yet unborn? Such ideas remain, to say the least, controversial. But one thing many in the field can agree upon is the need to take a cue from the Human Genome Project and launch a similar effort, this time to decipher the epigenome.
Mapping the human epigenome is the most important thing that we could do right now as a big project in science, because it will tell us some very important things about why organisms function the way they do, why cells have the behavior they do.
We now know how many genes we have, but we really don't know how they are regulated inside the cells. And mapping the epigenome will give us a much better understanding of this particular process.
The hurdle is that, unlike the genome, which is the same in every cell, the epigenome varies from tissue to tissue, between individuals, and over time.
If you thought sequencing the human genome took years and was difficult, you're talking about levels of complexity that will dwarf anything we knew about the human genome. But it's crucial, it's essential, that's the way that the future is going to unfold. So, in a sense, the Human Genome Project was just the beginning.
Dr. Schultz, we were talking about the nutrients and you were sharing with us all these methylating groups. Now, I encourage our viewers to eat brassicas, you know, the cabbage, the broccoli, mm-hmm. and all of those things, because we know that they're so powerfully cancer protective. Mm-hmm. Is there an epigenetic basis to that?
There is.
Really?
Yeah. And what I'm going to describe doesn't have to do with methylation. In this experiment, they looked at the acetylation. Sounds complicated, but mm-hmm. let me explain it. So we talked about, let's suppose this is your DNA. And we talked about these balloons, these histones that keep this DNA in place in the cell. And you have these arms wrapping around the DNA. So if they're wrapped, you can't read the DNA, you can't copy it. So it's switched off. Mm. And let's say that you have to put on rings in your fingers to open up the arms, okay? So as long as you have the ring, it's open and you can read it. So but there is constantly enzymes trying to get the rings out so that you pack again this DNA, the acetylases. And so they did that with broccoli sprouts, actually, with men in humans, so that they gave them a normal diet and then they had them eat broccoli sprouts. And then they measured the activity of this deacetylase enzyme. So if you want things to be able to be read, you want to have the arms open, so you don't want this enzyme to be active. And after eating the broccoli sprouts, if you look at the graph, you will see that the activity of the deacetylase went down, I mean, in a significant amount. After 3 hours, you had a very low deacetylase activity, and then it went a little bit up 6 hours afterwards, and then 24 hours later, it was up to normal. So, you know, if you can't eat broccoli or something similar every 24 hours, that would be great.
So that's amazing how quickly, yes. and such a big drop. Yeah. Very impressive. Now, John, there was a piece of news that we had here on the show recently, and I know you read that paper too, about sleep deprivation. Mm-hmm. How much sleep we get. So many people run short of sleep. Tell us what that study showed.
Well, there was a study at, I believe it was Surrey University in England, and they did a study with healthy young individuals whom they randomly assigned to half that were kept awake. They didn't have a good night's sleep. Mm-hmm. I believe they got 4 hours or less. The other half had plenty of sleep, all.
I think they had 9 hours.
Yes, I remember it was more than eight.
Yes, it was plenty.
I'm trying to think, when was the last time I got more than 8 hours? but then after the week of the difference, they kept them up for 40 hours and took blood samples looking for the epigenetic gene expression changes. And it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was 711, but it was over 700 genes that the expression was changed between the two groups as a result of sleep deprivation.
And that was, from what I recall, only two, it was basically a two-week study. There
yes.
was a week of this
yes.
and a week of that, and then they did the sampling.
That's right.
And, you know, with the Dean Ornish work, there was 3 months of mm-hmm. a particular diet, mm-hmm. and you saw that gene map with the heat map with 500 mm-hmm. changes. This was 700 in the space of 2 weeks
mm-hmm.
in fit, healthy young people. And we know that age impacts our epigenome. So these were young people, and I thought that was a profound finding that gives us a message about sleep, doesn't it?
That's right. You know, so we're realizing now that sleep has sort of been ignored as a lifestyle factor of disease. It's coming to be so much more understanding of how chronic sleep deprivation. Even one night without sleep is not ideal, but don't worry about that. It's the chronic situation where I'm just constantly not getting enough sleep. That's been associated with everything from obesity to cancer to heart disease.
Right, yeah. And I'm sure we're going to find a linkage there. Heidi, before we finish, last mm-hmm. question. You're at the coalface of this research. Tell us, is there any diagnostic or therapeutic tool that we could apply the epigenetics
yes,
to?
And we're going to see a lot coming in the coming years. One example, I know most people don't like a colonoscopy.
Mm.
So there is one that has been approved in the European Union. It's going through a revisal by the FDA in the US. So you measure the methylation status of one gene that is expressed in the colon normally. You just draw blood, measure if this gene is turned off or on. And if you see a lot of copies of this gene turned off, you know that person is probably in the process of developing colorectal cancer, so you can do more screening.
Mm-hmm. And so if it's not, you've skipped your colonoscopy. Wow, I love that application. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. We've run out of time today. Thank you, Dr. Kelly. Thank you, Dr. Schultz. It's been wonderful having you on the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
What if there's a switch that turns on cancer, heart attack, stroke, diabetes or obesity, and you could turn it off? Wouldn't you do it? There's now good scientific evidence that you can by eating whole foods, having sufficient sleep and getting active. And if you've not finished your family yet, you can pass those advantages on to your children and your grandchildren. Use your gene switches to go healthy for good. We'll see you next time.